Hello, listeners. Thank you so much for joining us today. We're excited to bring you this month's episode of Discourse, where we're talking about religion and how it shows up in public life and different classification matters of what does religion actually mean and what are the stories that we're reading this month tell us about what religion is and how it operates. I'm really excited to have two fantastic guests with us today, Carolyn Davis and Irene Oh, and we'll be talking about a number of different issues in both the United States and some issues that are touching on global affairs as well. I'll let Irene and Carolyn introduce themselves. Carolyn, would you like to go first?
Sure. Hi, my name is Carolyn Davis. I'm a resident here in Washington, D.C., and currently a outreach and messaging strategist for faith and a variety of progressive policy issues. I have bounced around here in D.C. In a variety of policy and outreach roles for organizations such as the Center for American Progress, Public Religion Research Institute, and the Center for Public Theology at Wesley Theological Seminary. I'm also an ordained United Methodist minister. I'm a deacon in the church, which means I work in specialized ministry, and for a long time have worked on issues related to adolescence, sexuality, progressive approaches to reproductive health and rights, and religious liberty. So thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, thank you so much. And Irene.
Hi, my name is Irene Oh, and I'm a professor in the Department of Religion and director of the Peace Studies and Conflict Resolution Program at George Washington University here in Washington, D.C. Most of my research has been on the area of Islam and human rights. More recently, I've been looking at issues of the ethics of motherhood, and I also have a fun project that I'm working on Islamic textiles and Islamic rugs.
Oh, wow. That sounds great.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Do you get to work with museums or anything with that?
There is a wonderful textile museum at the George Washington University that has a large collection of Islamic rugs.
Wow.
So it's perfect.
That's a good sighting for the podcast,
<That's right. laughs>
thinking about religion and public life. Great.
Yes.
Well, I would love to check that out. But today, I think we're going to start with a topic that we were discussing a little bit before we jumped on the recording, which is there are a number of interesting court cases in the United States this month where decisions were handed down about religion. So would you like to start us off with the Dominic Ray case?
Sure. So the Alabama Department of Corrections recently executed Dominique Ray, who is Muslim, and this was a very controversial case. It was a 5-4 split decision at the Supreme Court to vacate the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals to stay his execution on. January 23rd, as I understand it, Mr. Ray made a request to have an imam at his side in the death chamber and in the execution chamber. From what I've read, the Holman prison where he stayed had a Christian chaplain on staff, and he was the only authorized employee in a religion capacity who was permitted to stay in the execution chamber at the time of death. Mr. Ray's imam was allowed to tend to him prior to the lethal injection, but at the moment of death, he was required to stay in another room adjacent with a glass wall partitioning viewers and the correctional staff.
Yeah. So for our international viewers, this was a very controversial opinion in the United States. Obviously, a split decision, 5-4. Carolyn, what was your reaction to this, or what were some of the responses that you saw to the decision to the case?
So I think that I was initially pretty strongly taken aback by the lack of accommodation that was granted to Mr. Ray,
Dominique Ray.
And in particular, the fact that it stemmed from a practice of the prison to always provide a Christian chaplain upon request, and rather than simply the accommodation that the prisoners can frequently receive in prisons, which is simply someone of the same faith. I concurred with Justice Kagan that this is a pretty clear violation of the Establishment Clause, and that it was a pretty flimsy decision to suggest, as the court did, that the main problem lay simply in the fact that the complaint was brought too late. And in fact, this person should have somehow discovered this policy earlier, challenged it at an appropriate window of time, and sought relief. Justice Kavanaugh argued as much. I found that problematic. And I think in particular was sort of persuaded by a colleague of mine, Ian Millhiser's analysis of this, that there's a broader pattern here of issues around judicial empathy and whether or not cases are going to be more likely to be found in favor of these sort of Christians-only policies or less in favor of Muslim or other religious minorities when it is the case that the members of the court don't share in the same religious faith, that they're less likely to identify with the problem here. I thought that it was an interesting analysis. There's been other analyses lately around whether or not the court is trending hard right and trending towards being an exclusively Christian-favoring court. And that we aren't supposed to panic because court precedents over the last decade or so suggest that there are a variety of findings that complicate such a conclusion. And in fact, that we can see places where the court sided with religious minorities, atheists, and others. I think that that's also kind of a flimsy narrative because the particular makeup of the court at this particular moment in time was something, for instance, that Barack Obama questioned when he was a senator and opposed the Roberts nomination or challenged Roberts nomination, that more and more folks were arriving as nominees to the court who did not take empathy as a clear principle in thinking around judicial decisions. And in fact, that was going to lead to court decisions much like this, that there was a real risk in being able to think about religious diversity when it comes to finding for the most appropriate accommodation for folks appealing under these standards. So I think it then challenges us to ask some bigger questions about what may be coming. But I think it's pointing to where many folks who are often rendered invisible by the state, folks in prison, folks who are not afforded a lot of rights already, are losing an ability to be seen as folks with a valid claim to the rights afforded them under the law. And I think in one more way, we have the sort of invisibility of folks who are incarcerated and seeing their rights abused in ways that are really problematic. So,
and Irene, do you make anything of the fact that this was a Muslim inmate and that the four justices in the minority, a number of them are Jewish, and there weren't any Jewish justices in the majority? Is there something to make of the idea that members of the Supreme Court who are themselves members of a religious minority are siding with one side versus another, or is that irrelevant and it's more about their judicial philosophy, or is there some overlap between the two?
I do like this idea of judicial empathy, and I think that it shouldn't be divorced from the idea of a kind of intellectual curiosity about other religious traditions that actually have some material bearing on what it means to practice religion. If the inmate had been a Catholic prisoner who was refused last rites, for example, would Catholic members of the Supreme Court have had a more empathetic understanding and not have accepted the excuse of inexcusable delay, which is the terminology used in the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals decision to vacate the stay? Right, because they have an understanding of how important it is for someone who is of their religion to have a priest to be able to be there literally at the moments of the last breath to help usher the transition between this world and the next. And for many devout Muslims, and all records indicate that Ray was a devout Muslim who had been practicing, you know, at the prison since 2000, 6, and this particular imam had been tending to him since 2015, right? So for many devout Muslims, there is a rite, that a ritual that takes place called talqin, in which the imam whispers into the person who's dying as the dying person is taking his last breaths to recite the shahada, which is the statement that Muslims make to testify that there is only one God but God, and that Muhammad is his prophet, right? And this is literally done in the nanoseconds, right, before death. So having the imam actually be in a different room doesn't fulfill the requirements of the ritual. And so in this case, I think that some certainly empathy would have helped. But I think empathy, for one to be empathetic, one does not need to be Muslim necessarily. Right. I think one can be of any religious denomination or an atheist, sure, or agnostic. But I think that enough empathy to do some research.
Yeah.
You know, what does it mean to actually practice religion in such a way that the establishment clause is not violated? And here, this is not some random, obscure, esoteric ritual that hardly any Muslims practice. This is a vital, important ritual, and the last one that a person who is Muslim will undertake before he or she dies.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, that really makes me question how constitutional
right.
the vacate decision was.
Yeah. And I think as well that there's just something really staggering, sort of to move away from just sort of the judicial analysis, which I may be out of my depth on in a minute, but not being a lawyer, but the kind of deep cruelty that it takes for the state to say he can stand over there but not here. And the thinking about administering a chaplaincy program in a state institution that one appears to be deliberately discriminatory to folks facing execution, that two sort of puts folks who are facing execution at the whims of these state actors, but I think often probably just the folks at the prison who not only I think aren't particularly inclined to act generously to these folks, but seem inclined as well to really push the limits of what they can do in ways that will lead to additional suffering. And I find that as a minister, as someone who has often in my career trained others for ministry, really kind of horrified that this is the way a chaplaincy program is being administered, even before a prisoner, you know, himself or herself is attempting to assert their rights in a particular space. And that it should really, I think, raise among chaplains, among those interested in training folks for chaplaincy or care, a lot of questions, and hopefully I think an impetus for some action around this. This should not be happening in Alabama or anywhere else. And there are folks who are part of these networks of prison programs who have an ability to have some conversations there. Now, it is already, I think, remarkable that the gentleman had been receiving the care of an imam, mm-hmm. conversation and consultation, that had been made available regularly in Alabama, and speaks, I think, to the religious diversity of the state. That's also often overlooked. But I think as well that there are some professional ethics questions at stake here about how things are administered in the prison that are worth investigating as well.
Yeah. So this is a fascinating case, and I know we've already spoken for a good deal of time about it. And just in the interest of trying to bring out some of the other news items that we've seen over the past month, I want to turn to Carolyn and talk about another case that mm-hmm. brought up another question of judicial empathy. Mm-hmm. If you could speak just briefly about that, and then we can look at some issues that are not necessarily court-related.
Sure. So I want to talk a little bit about what just recently happened in South Carolina, where a court ruled that it would be all right for a foster care facility or program that receives federal funding. It's important to distinguish foster care facilities, there are those that are faith-based that do not receive any federal funding and those that do, to discriminate against folks who do not align with their faith commitments. In this case, a conservative Christian adoption care agency wanted the right to discriminate against Jewish couples seeking to adopt. What's interesting about this case is typically the controversy around whether or not in a federally funded adoption care facility can foster out or adopt out children using discriminatory kind of practices revolves around LGBT identity. Mm-hmm. And it's been found in polling that Americans overall oppose this. It's been the case that many states have actually put into place laws that prevent folks that from receiving aid from the state or from the federal federal agencies to discriminate against LGBT parents, but now we're seeing the this effort to discriminate also extended to religious identity, which is something that folks had kind of predicted may happen, and that in fact starts to open up this question about. What is the interest of an adoption care agency in when receiving funds? What role do they see that they have in the fostering of particular faith in the lives of the children that they serve? Is it to them to determine what that is? How do these children come to them? And is it worth keeping kids in temporary care, group homes, et cetera, in order to deny them parenting from folks of another faith? And I think that this is particularly poignant given the different ways we're thinking a lot about care of children right now in the national discourse. We're asking questions about kids in cages on the border. NPR yesterday did a set of reporting segments where they were actually inside a detention center where children were being housed. They weren't really able to identify some real reasons why these kids were being housed this way. But this real, I think, live question about what it means to care for children in our country right now who are children of poor, marginalized people is a real live one. And when courts are allowing for a sort of greater amount of latitude in keeping kids from good and otherwise qualified care, we have some real challenges on our hands for how we're thinking through what does it mean to serve children and families appropriately. Now, I'm a little biased, perhaps, on this one, and I'm actually interested to hear what you think, Irene, around whether or not courts should be making these accommodations for faith-based foster organizations to determine as a standard for who gets placement and who doesn't, mm-hmm. religious identity.
Right. It's interesting, and I'm curious, Irene, to hear mm-hmm. you talk, because there's a word that we've used in both cases but seems to be defined in different ways or applied to different people, which is accommodation.
Right.
So in the first case with Mr. Ray, an right. accommodation provided for his own religious beliefs to have right. his spiritual carer mm-hmm. present mm-hmm. In the execution chamber. Mm-hmm. And in this case with the adoption agencies, mm-hmm. there's a different kind of organization that's mm-hmm. asking for accommodation for a very different reason. So mm-hmm. do you see any connection between those two uses of the word accommodation, or are they quite different?
I would like to actually hear more about why these Christian adoption agencies think that Jewish or non-Christian yeah. families cannot accommodate children of other faiths. Mm-hmm. The reality in this country is that we have an increasing number of mixed faith families mm-hmm. and where we have families that are Jewish and Christian. I myself grew up in a family that was Buddhist and Presbyterian. So I would like to hear more about that reasoning. And, you know, going back to this theme of empathy, which I think is going to run through this entire podcast, the fact that children have very basic psychological needs that are best met through a very stable home life, that is being denied really alarms me. And the psychological trauma that is exacerbated through, you know, the delay of adoption, you know, by placing young children and taking them away from their parents at the border to be cared for by caregivers who don't even speak their own language. It's unfathomable. And I think, you know, many countries are judged, rightly so, by how they're best able to care for their weakest members of their societies. And these children are not being accommodated, at the very least, and certainly not cared for, I think, the best way that all medical and professional knowledge says is best for, in the best interest of the child, right? Which, you know, is a term that we oftentimes find in cases of bioethics, right, with regard to children. What is in the best interest of the child? And I wonder if that principle has been overlooked.
And I think what's interesting in this particular case, and I'm thinking right now about when I was at American Progress, I was part of a coalition that was looking at an interim rule that was put into place by the Office of Refugee Resettlement in conjunction with Health and Human Services. There was an effort made to carve out or create what we call a religious liberty carve out. So there was a preamble written to a set of guidelines around how unaccompanied minors who had just, I don't know if you remember, there was a period of time where there were some large groups of unaccompanied minors arriving at the border. Mm-hmm. Those had then, many of them, been taken into custody and then care. And so I'd come to CAPIT about the time that many of them were now fully kind of integrated into care systems. And the religious liberty carve-out was designed to this is a new thing, that there was a preamble that had been written, and there weren't typically preambles written to care guidelines. And out of nowhere, this preamble surfaced abortion in particular, mm-hmm. and indicated that nothing in the care guidelines that were being issued in this rule would hold should the caregiver or care providers receiving funding from the state or a subgrantee. So often money comes from federal and then down to the state and then down to what we call subgrantees. If they had religious objections, they would not need to execute the full standard of care. Not only would they not need to execute the full standard of care, which would include, for instance, if unaccompanied minors arrived in custody pregnant, found themselves pregnant. Often these children are raped either on their way north or while in custody. If they found themselves pregnant and sought abortion care, if there was a religious objection, they did not need to be counseled on their full range of reproductive health care options. They did not need to have care facilitated for them. So should the provider say, we oppose abortion, but you want it, therefore I will call services, they will come take you to the doctor, we won't facilitate that. They would not have to do any of that, and they would not have to tell the state. This should sound familiar if you followed the Hobby Lobby case, where folks not only did not need to provide to their employees reproductive health care and contraception should they not want to, but they also didn't need to file the form that would tell the state that this was being denied. So it sort of all happens in the dark. So I think what is so deeply troubling about this is there's a particular approach to the use of religion and religious belief to carry out one's particular ideas about socially what is okay, what is ethical, to execute one's ideas about homosexuality, but reproductive health care. And while people are entitled to those beliefs, what seems to keep happening is that those who are most vulnerable are the ones where those beliefs are then imposed. Unaccompanied minors can't assert themselves. Right. Prisoners on death row can't have something to say about it. Women who are dependent on insurance for full range of reproductive health care options and cannot pay out of pocket the full cost of their care are, if folks feel entitled, going to be denied what they need for religious reasons. And you know, I think we should be thoughtful about the fact that after 30 to 40 years of an effort to impose a particular kind of right-leaning, hard right, conservative-leaning set of ideologies around a lot of these issues, what seems to be happening is a settling for where they can be done statutorily, judicially, quietly on the state level. If you can't impose it on everybody, impose it on the most vulnerable. And I think that that's a really frightening and cynical understanding of what religious faith is, what religious practice is, what religious belief is, and what one's own responsibilities are as a citizen and a person of faith.
Yeah. So another really juicy topic that we could talk about for much longer. I do want to pivot, though, to something quite different, although the through line is homosexuality and LGBT issues have come up quite a bit. So maybe a little bit of a lighter issue in that it doesn't involve children who are detained. But in the news the last few weeks, or I guess the last week or so, there has been quite a bit of hubbub about a statement that Ellen Page made about Chris Pratt's attendance at a church that has a position that is often referred to as very anti-LGBT. Chris Pratt came out and said that he found the church to be very affirming of all people, that all people are welcome at the church, and that he himself has a position that is open to LGBT couples and the sort of love is love rhetoric. I wonder what we are to make of this. Importantly, I think sort of the context is that Ellen Page made a very impassioned plea for LGBT rights on the Colbert Report, or the Colbert Show, whatever it's called now, and was criticizing Chris Pratt's appearance on that show. Stephen Colbert, obviously, tongue-in-cheek, refers to himself as America's most famous Catholic. The Catholic Church is known for a very anti-LGBT stance on certain issues. So why do you think we see such a pile-on to this particular church in California that Chris Pratt attends, that has a position that I personally would not hold, whereas we don't see that kind of criticism of people who are Catholic, that Catholics are attending a church? Sometimes we do, but in this particular case, it seemed like there was a clear differentiation made between the two. Do you have any thoughts about that?
I think one thing that is being assumed, of course, is how long the Catholic Church has been around. And so there is a kind of gravitas there that – that one is Catholic because one's parents were Catholic, one's grandparents were Catholic, blah, 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 you know, on and on and on. But from what I understand, Hillsong is an evangelical church that, you know, you kind of join because your fellow celebrities joined and you need guidance at a particular time in one's life. And so it seems to be more of a choice than than belonging to a faith denomination that one inherits from one's family, right? And so, you know, the idea is that Chris Pratt, you know, this celebrity who, you know, by going to this church, is endorsing the church, can choose another church, right? That he doesn't necessarily have to go to this one, that he can go to another one that is much more LGBTQ friendly. And I think especially in Hollywood, because of the prominence of LGBTQ, you know, members of that kind of community, I think that Ellen Page was especially, is especially concerned that so many people with such a huge fan base would be following Chris Pratt. But, you know, the other thing realistically is that people belong to churches and synagogues and mosques, and they kind of pick and choose what they want to follow and are able to either ignore or kind of reason away what they don't. I mean, think about the number of Catholics who use birth control, right? Or, you know, I mean, to, you know, and or the number of Catholics who, you know, will stick with the church in spite of all of these abuse cases that have come out. So it's, you know, it's in some ways, I think it's unfair to single out Chris Pratt for attending this church when, in my estimation, I think the vast majority of people who attend, you know, religious services of some kind actually do not follow 100% of the principles that are endorsed by that particular denomination.
Yeah, I think that's a really excellent point. It lays bare, I think, some assumptions that we have about certain strands of religion in the United States being about an individualistic affirmation of certain creeds, which I think is a very Protestant understanding of what religion is, versus understanding religion as a communal identity that's not just about what you believe or do, but also about your family or where you're coming from and the history of that. So to me, it's a fascinating insight into the different definitions that we hold simultaneously in our head about what religion is and how it operates in people's lives.
Yeah. I mean, I think the aesthetics of this are really interesting as well. So Chris Pratt has been very open on Twitter and on Instagram about his growing commitment to this particular religious congregation, to the kind of renewal of a Christian faith that in his personal narrative he's always had. He was brought up relatively mainline to conservative, sort of your cornfed white boy sort of stereotype. But he has been really, really vocal. Instagram stories, Twitters, when he got engaged to, is it Catherine Schwarzenegger?
Yeah.
He talked in that engagement post about their life and faith together, using very particular vocabulary for that kind of religious tradition of which he is a part. And so I think just simply and when it comes to observing religion in pop culture, this is interesting because it is less frequently that we see celebrities have their faith on the tip of their tongue as they talk about their life. In almost every interview he does, he talks about this journey that he's on. Now, at the same time, it's worth noting this particular congregation, the pastor that leads it was blamed for Justin Bieber canceling half a tour to focus more on his faith. And in fact, there was a rumor that Justin Bieber was actually being groomed, much in the same way that Miscavige groomed Tom Cruise to take over this congregation, which is, I don't think it's the flagship Hillsong congregation. I might be wrong on that, but I don't think it is. But it is considered kind of probably the most moneyed and high profile. Selena Gomez has been linked to the congregation. So there have been other celebrities that have been a part of this. I think one of the crucial differences is that Pratt has drawn attention to this congregation through his own personal narrative using social media. So it's made him a target, I think, in ways that other celebrities who as they got involved, simply dropped off the planet, really, and stepped back from their own professional lives. This is a kind of a different story and an interesting, I think, example of what happens when a celebrity elects to align themselves with a congregation whose beliefs aren't probably fully in step with where an increasing number of folks of his age and younger are and his fan base are. And in the same time, Ellen Page has kind of been a noted celebrity using her platform to talk about LGBTQ rights, going on this traveling tour, doing listening, showing up at different kinds of public events to talk about these issues. And I think her pushback then raises another kind of big and interesting question about the assertion of LGBTQ friendly policies and being a spokesperson for that. And to what extent can you carry that out before you bump up against personal religious belief and practice? And then what is the right or what are options for dialogue when you begin to kind of hit in that particular moment? I mean, as someone whose denomination is currently possibly considering splitting over homosexuality, I can tell you I'm a member of a tradition that doesn't espouse what I would like to see when it comes to full LGBT equality, just within my denomination, let alone what it means to be on the side of good policies. So this is a really complicated question, but the Instagram part of this to me is just utterly fascinating too.
If it will help religious literacy among the youth, that's probably a good thing.
Yeah, definitely. So I know we're running out of time. I want to try to get in one story with a little bit more of an international component to it, which was the story, which is still about the United States, about Ilhan Omar and her comments about AIPAC and whether her comments were anti-Semitic, whether they were a valid critique of an organization that has a pro-Israel platform, or was it an anti-Semitic attack by using language that draws attention to money and obviously long-standing tropes about Jews being money-hungry? So what are we to make of this story and the public reaction to it? I have found it quite interesting that more than many accusations of anti-Semitism in the past, I've seen members of the progressive Jewish community come out very much in favor of Ilhan Omar and her response to it, sort of taking ownership for what she said, but also noticing that the really virulent critiques of Omar may be due to the fact that she's Muslim, that she's African, of African descent, herself coming from Somalia. So what are we to make of this story?
I think that all of those things matter. And I think that this is just part of kind of a larger culture that we have, I think, of being very, very careful about what we say so as not to offend, right? I think that Ilhan Omar did, unfortunately, kind of cross the line and, you know, basically buy into this trope, right, of Jews ruling the world through money with her tweet. And I think the tweet was, it's all about the Benjamins, baby, right, which is unfortunate. And yeah. Especially because she is a very high-profile freshman Democrat. You know, people are watching her. And so, you know, I think this is a lesson also about her newfound fame in some ways and how careful she needs to be with the power that she has. That being said, I do think that there should be space to talk about and to criticize Israeli policy, right? And to talk about the role of money in Congress. And I think that conversation has to be had. But, you know, to kind of flip the script a little, you know, we also need to be able to be very critical of, for example, Muslim majority countries without being Islamophobic.
Right.
Right. So, you know, to kind of detach our critiques of policies that we find to be harmful without kind of veering into stereotypes that are negative based on people's faith, I think is something that we will need to keep an eye on, especially with Tlaib also, mm-hmm. who's another prominent freshman congresswoman in this term.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Carolyn, you want to have the last word on this?
I mean, I agree, and I think that the analysis here that centers race, centers religion, and I think gender and age as mm-hmm. well is really important. The Republicans are no strangers to members of Congress, sitting members of Congress, saying a variety of deeply racially problematic things. Donald Trump likes to, when he meets with groups of Jewish people, talk about how much they like money. So it is not the first time, any time recently, we have seen something that could be read as anti-Semitic coming out of the mouth of one of our elected officials. And we have seen far more dramatically problematic things coming out of the mouths of folks that are still sitting in their elected seats. Steve King was stripped of his committee assignments, but he is still in office. And I don't see any Republicans calling for his resignation. And so, you know, I think that we need to continue to be thoughtful about where this ire is directed and in what forms it takes. And I think you're right to look as well at the fact that coming down the line may be additional sort of heightened standards of critique for our other Muslim, newly elected Muslim female member of Congress as well. Yeah, I'll stop there.
Yeah. Well, that's a great place to stop. We've covered a lot of territory today. I think we've discussed a number of fascinating news stories, and I know each of us has three more that we could talk about just from the past month. So there's so much to discuss, a great example of why it's important to analyze religion and public discourse. Mm-hmm. I want to thank you both, Carolyn and Irene, for coming in today. It was a pleasure being with you both. And I hope our listeners enjoyed today's discussion, and we look forward to having you back to hear more from Discourse in the future. So thanks so much.
Thank you. The RSP is sponsored by the British Association for the Study of Religions, the North American Association for the Study of Religion, and the International Association for the History of Religions. The Religious Studies Project is produced by the Religious Studies Project Association, SCIO, a Scottish charitable incorporated organization, charity number SC047750. Brought to you by founders and editors-in-chief Chris Cotter and David Robertson, and managing editor Thomas J. Coleman III. Our features are edited by Marek Sullivan and Rebecca Barrett-Fox, and our opportunities digest by Ella Bock. podcast transcription by Helen Bradstock, with audio editing by Gregory Schneider and Samuel Ward, social media managed by Ray Radford, sales and marketing by Sammy Bishop, and video editing by Jonathan Tuckett. Don't forget, you can support the project by using our amazon.com.co.uk and .ca links, or donating at patreon.com/projectrs, and you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, YouTube, iTunes, and other portals.